grades are historically actually used to let you know what you're getting yourself into, right? It's like, hey, just a heads up, this is hard. And not so much like, this is hard and thus you're great. It's more like a warning, like, if you're going to tie in and go up this, like, just a heads up, this is hard. And the side note to that is that this is where you need to respect each climb, and you can get your ass kicked on any grade. You can fall off. I mean, clearly you can fall off a V0. Of course, you can fall off anything. If you come at it with the wrong mentality, not only will you get shut down sometimes and then your ego hurts, you also might be prone to climb it in a suboptimal way, like forcing it, making a V6 into a V10 just because you get angry at it. But then without that respect, you also reduce your chances of learning. Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast.
Okay, we're winging it.
Let's start right there. All right. I like that start. Tim, my dude, how's it going, man?
Josh, what's up? It's going great, honestly. Fired up, as always.
But... dude, we've just been talking nonstop for the last half an hour, and then we had to click record because we got all super psyched. Tim, it's cold, dude. I'm wearing long johns right now, Tim.
Wow, in the house.
Yeah, I'm in my basement, which, you know, basements are always a little bit colder. I don't even know if you call this a basement, but I'm in the lower floor and it's cold. I've got long johns. And dude, I love the cold. I just wish it was always like this, just year round. I like the cold, man. I'm a mountain guy. What can I say?
Yeah. I like the cold too. I always grew up liking the cold, and I kind of hated the sluggy feeling of the heat and stuff, but I moved to Las Vegas and unfortunately, I kind of fell in love with the warm as well, but man, it's getting cold and I'm getting like, I get more excited. Like I get more like into the cold things, I feel like.
Well, I feel like the cold makes you want to get up and do stuff, and you can always put on another jacket, right? But when it gets hot, you just want to lay in front of a fan and do nothing. And that's not what I want to do. I want to get out and climb hard. And I think also my love of the cold is that I have sweaty hands, or, you know, like I'm the sweaty guy at the gym or outdoors. And so for me, the colder it is, just I climb harder, and I like climbing harder. I don't know.
That's one thing American gyms definitely have. Well, a lot of American gyms, especially the gyms in California, they're cold, dude. Like Salt Lake gyms are pretty cold. And then, you know, the first time I went to Europe, I went in the summer for the World Cups, and we were competing pretty regularly in like the 70, 80, even 90 degree temps. And then you go to the gym during the weeks and it'd be like no AC in a single European gym. And it's like 90 degrees, 100 degrees in the week. And you're like, wow, like it's pretty hard to climb when it's really hot. And you never really have that problem as much in the States, I feel like.
Yeah, screw that. I just not psyched in that. I will go out when it's super cold and just be psyched. And I feel like I keep my skin stays around for longer. I was actually, as I was thinking about being cold, I was thinking about like my coldest sessions and if they were correlated with being good hard sending. And it's not always that clear where like I have climbed my best when it's super cold. And I can think of one where there's this boulder. I guess it depends on rock too. Like there's this boulder around here on the couch boulder. And I went in December and it was freaking cold and it just felt glassy and slippery, but that's full of that kind of granite without a lot of grain, like those kind of flat edges that are just, I don't know, you know, just they're not glassy. It's just they aren't that crystally painful, need callus kind of climbing in Bishop, and you can just kind of slip off them. So I guess it's not always necessary, but still my favorite.
Well, actually, so I read that in your notes, and I had a point kind of right away on that. And something I've been learning and Nate, Twig is staying at our place right now, and he's trying to return to the Sleepwalker. And we were talking about Sleepwalker a bit, and like what feels good when, like why it doesn't feel good sometimes. And he like just had a session. He's like, dude, it felt horrible. And I was like, dude, my last session felt horrible. And he was like, I think it's more humid. And I was like, oh, interesting. Like, I thought it was really humid too. And basically, like, it was really cold. It was the coldest day by like 20 degrees for my last four sessions on it. It was 20 degrees colder than any of my sessions. And it was perfect feeling. Like, you walked out, I was like, oh, it's going to be so good. And you showed up and I started warming up and I was like, man, it's like still kind of got that weird feeling on my fingers. And then I grabbed the hold and it felt like glass. And I was like, weird. Like, it's cold. Like, cold means dry too, doesn't it? And I was like, oh, dude. And one thing I explained to Nate was the sloper on Sleepwalker, like the actual Crux sloper, it's got kind of a bump on it. And when you're really dry skin and it's really cold, it feels like a perfect sloper and a slopey sloper. But when it was cold and humid, it felt like a crimp. It felt like a sharp crimp. It felt like stingy. And so my read on like outdoors when it's cold and humid is that things could sting more, things are way more slicker, and it feels a little bit more glassy too. And so in Bishop too, I did like 10 sessions on Spectre, and I had like two or three sessions also that felt impossible to climb it. Like I couldn't even generate to that last crimp. And those are usually the humid sessions as well. And so humidity, I think, matters maybe even more than the cold, but the cold almost always generates dryness. And so it was kind of weird to get humid, cold days, I guess. It's like my
not gonna lie, this is maybe my least favorite thing about hard climbing is dealing with conditions and worrying about this stuff and bringing a fan or like it just is a big difference though. When you can stick, you're psyched. And I mean, I always think about Bishop and having those cold, dry days and having those callous skin. And then when you grab onto those crystals, I was going to say it's almost like cheating, but it's almost necessary where when you have that thick layer of callus and it's cold, where the rock actually digs into your skin in the sense that you take your finger off and you can see the crystal like indented in your skin and you're getting that grip. I know. Dude, it is a really I mean, this is one of the things that's brutal about hard outdoor climbing and changing into it. And that's our topic for today is this changing of the season and how to set yourself up from going from your sweaty summer gym sessions to cranking on little bitty crystals in the cold outdoors. And there is an element of having to just get acclimated by doing it. Like you are not going to get that hardcore dry callus where you dig into that bitey crystal on Spectre or whatever without kind of showing up. But hopefully we're going to give some tips as to how to make that transition and how to make it without getting injured and how to make it as quickly as possible. But, you know, the spoiler is that you kind of have to show up and do it a little bit. But that was my spoiler, Tim.
Nice. Yeah, dude, I almost could just jump straight into this topic. But yeah, should we do the non-topic things first?
Yeah. But I will put in my pro tip for climbing in the cold since we're talking about the cold. And this will totally transition into the topic later too. And so this pro tip is about climbing in the cold, but it's probably more specifically for climbing outdoors. And it really comes down to just warming up for so long. Like you just have to... And that could mean that off the wall, warming up a little bit of, I don't know, running around, stretching, doing your jumping jacks. But honestly, for me, it just means climbing and climbing and climbing. And normally maybe you'd climb a V0, a V3, a V5 or whatever, and just kind of be like, oh, okay, like got my movement down, feeling it. But when it's seriously cold, you know, like 25 degrees or something, or whatever seriously cold means to you, you just got to stick with it and it takes a lot longer and you'll feel like crap. Everything will be cold and just keep going. And then once you kind of switch over and you're like, oh dude, like I'm warm and things feel sticky and I am psyched. You kind of can't stop. Like you have to just keep going. And those are my best days. Like I was thinking about one of my coldest days was in Rocktown down in the South and it was so cold. Oh, actually here's how cold it was. We were on Golden Harvest, which is this incredible V10, just really cool V10. And my buddy opens up a Red Bull and then he sets the Red Bull next to us. And then we climb for 10 minutes and then he takes a sip of the Red Bull and it had slushy in it. It was like slushy. Whoa. After opening it, it started to freeze.
That's awesome.
But that was one of my best days. I did. Yeah, that was a good day for me. Did a lot of new V points.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that pro tip is super, super good. And it's a pretty important aspect of climbing, because you could easily go out in the cold, you know, for your first time outside, especially if you go to like Bishop or something, and you're like, oh, F this, like, this is not what I want to be doing. And it's like, well, it's what you kind of have to be doing if you want to be climbing hard, right? And so it's like, well, how do you do that? And for me, I 100% agree. I think staying warm and getting really warm is a huge aspect of climbing hard when it's cold. Because things will stay cold, but you can't stay cold. Like, your body has to be a pretty hot temperature so that you're like elastic, dynamic, committing to things, and your fingers are actually ready and safe. And then you have good footwork. You can feel the lower body and feel the core engage and stuff like that. And for me, I think the thing that is significant to kind of do before that pro tip is staying warm is getting psyched. If I'm not psyched, I can't get warm. Like, if I'm not psyched to move, and like, because it's horrible and because it's miserable and you're freezing and stuff, like, it's like getting out of bed. Literally, you kind of just have to be sometimes like, okay, let's go. You know, like, literally, I think that, and that maybe that'll just be my pro tip. Like, get some phrase or cue or like friends or Red Bull. You know, like, sometimes for me, Red Bull's not necessarily placebo because it has physical properties, but the placebo that Red Bull does for me is that it gets me psyched, you know, it just gets me going, and it just turns into the, like, let's go. And I don't drink Red Bull much anymore, but like, and we're not sponsored by Red Bull or anything, but I would, you know, sometimes if I knew that I had a session, and usually what Brent and I would do is Brent and I would always go on trips together and like do the long winter trips. We always had Red Bull in the glove box or like in the back seat or something. We literally always had one there, and we didn't always drink one. Well, he drank one a lot just because, but I would always have one there just in case it was too cold for me to start getting warm. It's literally just for the warm up. Because what you're right, yeah, once you get warm, it's just, it keeps going. You can't stop.
So, Tim, your pro tip is just, it's basically do drugs to get you psyched. That's like, that is what you're saying. Because Red Bull is just straight caffeine to the dome. And yeah, dude, caffeine works like a freaking charm. Although I will say, be careful on dosing up on caffeine too much. You get the jitters, kind of, you get that shaky leg, you sweat a little bit more. I mean, dude, I'm a full on caffeine addict, but just a warning. And dude, you just reminded me, when I was a kid, I used to climb up at Cave Rock, which is this sweet big cave of sport climbing on Lake Tahoe that unfortunately got closed down and got the bolts chopped. But I started going there back in, like, I don't know, like 94 or something, like a long freaking time ago. And we would go to this little gas station, and they had Red Bull there. And so this is like almost 30 years ago. It was totally unknown back then. And I'm like a 10-year-old kid just getting jacked off of these Red Bulls. And so, yeah, that's how I got introduced to Red Bull. But I do love that ritual idea. And it was something I was going to bring up later on in the podcast, where oftentimes when you start climbing outdoors, it throws you out of your normal kind of day-to-day schedule, where all of a sudden maybe you're climbing at 8 a.m. or at 8 p.m., where maybe you're used to just always going at the same time after work or whatever. And so I'm a big fan of rituals to get you into that state of mind. And I usually have a song, and I think it's funny because I wrote that down. And I was getting my ass kicked this morning by other work stuff. And I was like, I was not so psyched. I wasn't super psyched up. So I listened to my song and it got me psyched. And I was just wondering, nice. Tim, do you have a psych up song?
I do, actually. I have a couple of different moods. I had a go-to for a long time. I had a couple of go-tos for a long time, but honestly, lately it's been like, I'm going back to the kind of like what more kids listen to nowadays. I know I'm a kid to you, but I listen to like more Taylor of the newer stuff now. Yeah. Yeah. Taylor Swift. No, like Polo G or like Lil Durk type stuff, like a little bit more like hip hop type feel. But I used to listen to a lot more rock. Like if I just threw on any Linkin Park or like, I don't know, Slipknot or like Avenged Sevenfold or like anything that was a little bit harder and darker, that usually would get me going. But nowadays it's kind of like, I just put on a Polo G radio and I'm like, all right, cool. Like, I'm stoked to climb now. It's changed a lot over the years.
Dude, I like all of those. That's classic. I for some reason, I definitely love hip hop and rap. I feel like you can't watch a climbing video that's not set to hip hop or rap in some sense. Although we were just talking about that Dave Graham video of him doing that new V16.
And yeah.
That's kind of like some old school rock. But yeah, I think it's good to have a song. I, I listen to, this is like my random one, is Batoko, Raining Again, which you've never heard of, and I had never heard of it, but I don't know, it just got stuck in my head as my psych song. And then I listened to, what's it called? Sky by, who is it? Like Playboy Cardi or something? I should look it up. I don't know. I'll link in the show notes, but I like your Slipknot recommendation too. That's
actually, I used to listen to,
gets me right in my teenage angst.
The one song I would always put on was Legacy by Eminem. That one for me was like a good one. Eminem, like, I think we stopped listening to Eminem. Brent and I used to listen. We would just put on a lot of old Eminem songs, but we stopped listening to like Lose Yourself and stuff because that just became too, like, I don't know, corny. Like, it could be too corny sometimes. Like, you can't play like what is that Journey old rock soundtrack? Like,
Don't
you
Stop
can't play
Believin'.
Like Don't Stop Believin' or something. Like, you can't. Well, maybe some people can, but like for me, it's too corny. It has to be a little more legit than that, I feel like.
Okay. Those are all our musical recommendations. But I do think just something about having that ritual is important for getting your mind right. Because, yeah, that's part of that mental game. And getting psyched is, I don't know, just recognizing what you're there for. And I remember hearing about how warm-ups are at least half for your mindset as your body, just like, okay, I'm here to do this. Like, let's do it. So go listen to Tim's favorite band, Slipknot. I think I saw Slipknot in concert, man. It was one of my first concerts. Yeah. And, and System of a Down was there, and Rammstein. Yeah, it was good. Good. I feel your teenage angst, and you're looking back at that stuff as like old stuff, but I was there right when it came up. And,
that's crazy.
Yeah. Good times, man. Okay, Tim, let's get to our controversial topic. This is not the overarching topic of the day, but actually, this isn't controversial. I'm going to call it explosive. So Sean Bailey made a post on Instagram that got a ton of attention. I'm sure it was blowing up all of your reshares, or it's just like all over my feed. It got like 15,000 likes and 350 comments in a day or something. So Sean Bailey, badass, amazing climber, competitor, everything climbing. Basically, he made a post after his disappointing Pan Am result, which is, maybe you can speak to this, Tim, after I've done, where I don't know all the ways it works, but my understanding is that Pan Am is a comp where if you win it, you get a ticket to the Olympics. And so I'm sure everyone saw those posts, like Natalia Mate got a ticket, Jesse Grupper got a ticket, but Sean was there, and you know, he didn't place as well. I mean, God, I think he's still podium, but he didn't win, and that just it's not hilarious, but it shows how good Sean is, where you know, anything but number one doesn't make him happy, and he was disappointed. And so, you know, that was kind of the overarching thing, but the post he made was really heavy because I'm just going to say it in this little quote that I got from his post, where he said, "The real reason I felt so much pressure was because I didn't feel like I was just fighting for my ticket to the Olympics. I felt like I was fighting for my career." And that's really heavy, because that post where it highlighted that he was disappointed with this Pan Am result and that he didn't qualify for the Olympics, which was what he was working towards and a personal dream of his. Damn good personal dream, by the way. It just made him feel like also he was not being supported by the industry, and his dedication as a professional climber wasn't being supported by everyone around him, and that he was struggling to make a living. And the fact that he didn't make it to the Olympics made him feel like, you know, he was kind of on the downslope of his career. And, you know, first of all, it was a beautiful, authentic, genuine post. Like, Sean, just way to go. Like, that was just so well written and so honest. I felt like, you know, he probably just wrote it in 2 minutes and posted it, but it was so good. And I gotta say, I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen written by a professional climber, at least in a long time. So just cool to see someone show up on social media in a way that was not so edited and, you know, glamorous, just real honest emotion. And yeah, I wanted to bring it up because it was clearly resonated with the whole community. And I know, you know, Tim, you have thoughts on it, and I had thoughts on it. And so we talked about it for like an hour before even clicking record. But maybe you can sum up the post in your way too and make sure I didn't leave anything out.
Yeah, no, I think I kind of want you to just take the mic on it because you explain it so good. But yeah, I will say that the implications of the event specifically were huge, and not necessarily just the implication. I mean, you can see in a lot of people's posts, like I think Toby just made it to Paris and Orianne made it to Paris. And like, there's so much emotion behind these tickets. There's, you know, for basically, I think there's 6 continental championship events, and the winner of each of the continental championship events will get the ticket to the Olympics. And then the other 14 spots per gender, right? 'Cause there's only 20 spots per medal. And so we're not talking about speed, but for bouldering, and it's a bouldering and lead medal that you can get for, it's a bouldering and lead spot. So it's still combined competition, but you're not doing speed anymore. And these guys train, and they're all really good at bouldering and lead, right? And so these guys are training really, really hard for it since basically like pre-2020. And, you know, we're going for 2024 Olympics at this point. These guys have been training as Olympians since, you know, 5 years ago. And Pan Am specifically is a really high implication event because of how, it's horrible to say, but how easy it is relative to like any other Olympic ticket. You know, to get another Olympic ticket, for example, you would have to place in, I think, the World Championships or like in the entire world ranking, which is basically getting out of the World Cups. And so out of the entire World Cup season, you can get a world ranking at the end of the season. And I think in the top, whatever amount of spots, we get Olympic ticket. I think that's how they did it the previous season. And so obviously going to Pan Americans where, you know, there aren't that many strong Brazilian climbers. There aren't that many strong any climbers in South America, to be honest. I mean, not, you know, there was only like one or two in the final, and there aren't that many strong Canadian climbers, at least not, you know, as much anymore. And so for an American to go, you know, when you're going with Jesse, you know, Jesse, Sean, and Zach, or whoever else is there, those are all people who can easily win, who all podium. Yeah, it was Jesse first, Sean Bailey second, and Zach all a third. Like, you know, each of them all feel equally worthy, strong, deserving of that ticket. And so unfortunately, you're going to get the one. And yeah, it's hard, but Sean is probably the best American competitor in the male field for a long time. And unfortunately, he probably, you know, should have gotten that ticket just based on face value. But man, to credit Jesse, like he crushed that event, like to come out from that bouldering around. Maybe this is kind of what I want to speak on a little bit before we go into the Sean topic. Like, I mean, Jesse's ability to go into a lead round with any amount of pressure and any amount of, you know, implication on the line and do well on a lead route. I mean, his lead score was insane. He fell on like the last hold. He fell like with his hand on the last hold. And that route looked insane, by the way. And a huge score jump from pretty much everybody else beneath him. And that's kind of the thing with the bouldering lead competitions is that you can do, you know, bouldering is where you try to get as many points as possible on these really, really hard problems. But lead's where you go and clean up your score and you try to get as far as you can. And that's kind of where it was pretty obvious that Jesse really cleaned up the show, you know. But unfortunately, that means that Sean's not going to shine and, you know, Sean's not going to get his ticket. And I think that can mean a lot of things, right? And so going into this kind of other side.
Well, yeah, the other side of the post is kind of what made it explosive. But the last thing I want to say on the actual competition and the words that Sean used was he said something along the lines of, I deserve this, not because they didn't deserve it, but because I did everything I could to prep for it. And I loved what he said there, where it really highlights something that I love about climbing competition or climbing in general, and really any super high level sport, is just that self-belief. Trying his best, preparing his best, putting it all out there. And, you know, it's too bad that it didn't work out for him, but I just love, he didn't say anything negative about his other athletes and his other competitors and friends. He said good things about them. You know, it wasn't that they didn't deserve it, just that he really hung it all out there. And I just loved how he phrased that. I thought that was really cool.
I think that's how comps always feel, by the way. Yeah, I love climbing comps for that reason, because it is individual and most competitors feel like that, which is awesome. But I'm glad that he highlighted it on that post. You're right. But yeah, sorry, take the mic. Yeah, go for it.
I mean, I just want to go on to what made this, again, I'm using the word explosive and why it really got shared, is that what really Sean led into after, again, you know, describing his disappointment at this competition is inability to get a ticket to the Olympics, is his struggles as a professional climber and how he he's made it. I think he said it in his word, he achieved everything that he could have ever hoped to do in the competition world up to this point, where I think he, you know, was one of the first American men to win World Cup boulders and lead, and not ever, but just in the past, you know, few decades and kind of this modern world. He really blazed the trail when it came to hard USA climbing on the World Cup series. Full stop. And he's also climbed unbelievably hard routes and boulders. I mean, I don't even need to list all the amazing things he's done there. And the struggle he had was that he said he's done it. He dedicated himself to all of this, ticked all the hard climbs, pushed the competition side forward. Really, I think that the argument you would make is that he's exactly the kind of athlete that we all look up to, that we all wish to, that every 13-year-old kid right now is saying, like, wow, I wish I could be like Sean. I wish I could win World Cups. I wish I could climb V16 and 515 B or C or whatever it is, you know, just like he's done it. But with all that said, he's really struggling to make a career as a professional. And that's where a lot of people chimed in and are disappointed, where someone who's arguably, you know, in the running for, you know, one of, at the very least, one of the top USA climbers that we've ever seen, at least in the modern era, especially, and he's struggling to make it. And, you know, that's a tough reality in our industry that is really upsetting. And we see a lot of other climbers who are in similar positions where, you know, if Sean's not able to make it, then what chance do I have as an up and coming climber or an aging climber? And it really started a big conversation. And, you know, I at the very least wanted to just bring up Sean's beautiful post and how he wrote it out. And, you know, we're not going to solve anything on this podcast about what the industry could do or should do, or what Sean could do or should do, but at the very least wanted to kind of amplify his message and make everyone think, because Sean is an incredible climber. And if he can't make it, it's a bummer, because he's done a lot.
Yeah. This conversation is always so hard for me, and it brings up so many emotions. And, you know, one note that I'll make here, I guess, because Josh is right in that we won't solve anything on this podcast, and, you know, and we already had our kind of like long, and Josh and I have probably spent a fair amount of hours going back and forth on this type of topic, kind of about the position of industry and business, and kind of, it's just interesting. It is an interesting world, you know. On the other side of talking, because we can look at this light in Sean's position and be like, well, it's sad and whatnot. But it's also just interesting how the world's working, and, you know, how the world in climbing is working as well. But yeah, I guess my big feeling about it is that it's just horribly sad, right? Like, I was that 13-year-old who, you know, I looked up to Sean a long time ago, you know, and I still definitely look up to Sean. You know, we have our, I wrote a post that also got like 100, I wrote a comment that got like 100 likes. I was like, dude, how are these comments getting like absurd amounts of likes? But I just said, like, you know, we didn't always see eye to eye, and like Sean and I have gotten arguments. Like, we have not always been friendly to each other, but there's like one thing that's never changed is my respect for him as an athlete. And it's cut clear and dry. He's one of the best that's ever touched the rock. He's one of the best that's ever competed. And that's also hard to do both of those two things. Okay. It's very, very rare that you're seeing somebody who can climb V16, 15D, and win World Cups regularly, which is pretty crazy. And so my respect for him is very, very obviously high. And I think that's what makes me sad, is that, as, you know, person aside, the athlete that he is should be a rock star. I should see him on posters. I should see him on magazines. I should see him on, you know, whatever, for whatever he's doing. And even the news of him, you know, on his incredible sends are pretty like muddled, and like, you don't even know, not that many people would know exactly what his resume would look like. You know, like, I didn't even know when he did Grand Illusion very much. And for some reason, like, other people sending 515A could be more popular than him sending Bibliography, you know? And it's like, dude, what? Like, what's going on here? You know, it's such an interesting thing. But I guess the big point here for me is that it's pretty sad, dude. Like, you know, he is a rock star, and he always was a rock star, and, you know, and he's always going to be a rock star. And maybe because of how the industry works right now, he's probably not going to be highlighted as a rock star in that way. Well, maybe his posts will change things, but so far, I mean,
nothing that happens, no matter what, will ever take away that he kind of just is a rock star too. I mean, you know, I think that people listening to this podcast, because we're more along the lines of people who care about really amazing climbers, you know, everyone knows that name and has images in their head of like that one amazing move he did in that comp. I'm blanking. It was like
in the Salt Lake World Cup.
I think didn't Nathaniel Coleman say on the podcast that that was like the coolest move he'd ever seen or the coolest moment?
That was the coolest moment. We were all watching that live too, dude. Like nobody had even done that boulder. Like nobody had even touched the finish hold and he flashed the boulder.
Yeah. So like, what? He will be a rock star no matter what, but I just thought it would be interesting to kind of take both sides, right? I want to, because I can see it from both sides where I understand maybe why it's so upsetting to see him struggling and why he may be struggling from like the business standpoint. And, you know, again, we're not going to solve anything here, but I think that this conversation is both interesting and can maybe help people who are up and coming or maybe people who are already doing it and are rock stars, but maybe are not recognized as much. And I think that something that we talked about, Tim, that really resonated with me is just this recognition that the brands that we all support and use, you know, the climbing shoe companies, the whatever, the gear companies, kind of the brands that we think of, whether that's gyms or whatever the case may be, that they could capitalize more on these pro climbers, that there's opportunities that they're leaving on the table to highlight someone like Sean that just aren't quite being utilized, because Sean is just, I mean, well, first of all, he's well spoken or well written, because we saw that on the post. It was beautiful. He's unbelievably talented and he's got a platform. People know who he is. So, you know, I think the hope from the climbers that want to solve issues like this, where Sean's struggling to make it financially, doing the thing that we all love seeing him do, is just that the brands could do a better job at utilizing his specific talents to, you know, help the industry as whole, to, in that sense, helping the brands make more money so that they can pay Sean more money, so that he can do cool things, so that he can inspire more people, so that the brands can make more money, so that he can make more money, so that the 13-year-old kid looking up to Sean will have a place to go when they get older and achieve all the things that they're dreaming of too. And so I think that's kind of one of the biggest critiques that we see from pro climbers, is that they feel like they're really holding up their end of the bargain, where they're doing amazing things, trying so hard day in and day out. And maybe that's not amplified in a way that it could be compared to other sports. Does that make sense, Tim?
This hits home. It feels good to hear Josh say this, by the way, because Josh is always quick to, for me, in our personal conversations, I'm usually the one advocating this side and Josh is usually the one advocating the other side, because it makes sense, you know, and I agree with both sides, and I'm here to stand for both sides as well. But this is the one that hits home for me. And, you know, this conversation came up recently when we had Andy Lamb on the podcast. Andy Lamb's also a V16 climber. And since I was a kid, Andy was a rock star. But I don't think he's ever been sponsored. You know, I don't think he's ever been sponsored. And that's, for me, was just like, huh? Like, it wasn't even, you know, these thoughts didn't necessarily occur about like what an industry, you know, in my opinion, should or could do. It literally was just like, what? Like, what? Why is that guy not represented by like 5'10" or whatever, you know, La Sportiva or whatever shoes he's wearing? Like, he's a rock star. He's one of the best ever wearing your shoes, you know? And so it was a confusion thing for me, where representation started to kind of, I started thinking about what representation meant and like what it should be and like what it should feel like. And I guess like the feelings that athletes do have, you're right, are kind of that we put our end of the bargain up and somebody else doesn't. And in whatever way to amplify what we're saying, maybe they don't have to highlight it the same language that we're doing, but I like that word you're using, amplify what we're already trying to do and whatever we're trying to speak about. And I do say we, because I'm also an aspiring professional athlete and I feel these things as well. And, you know, and on that note, I tried to capitalize on this other side of what we're talking about, but it feels wrong for me to do that, to be honest. You know, just to be frank, it feels wrong, right? Even though it's the right thing to do to capitalize on the world and the realities in the industry, it feels wrong, because, you know, an athlete has a specific position. An industry and a brand and a company always has a position to create an image, is, I guess, like my point here. And with Sean specifically, you know, he's already doing the things that he's doing, and he already spends all the time and the investment and the effort and the energy and the personality to put into his climbing and the hard climbing and whatnot. And it seems pretty easy to like make a movie about him. Like, it seems pretty easy to do that. You know, it seems pretty easy because you can just ask him like, hey, what would you want to make a movie about? And he's like, oh, I don't know, dude. Like, I want to go and do this thing. It's like, well, somebody turn a camera on, follow the guy and make a cool flick, right? Because like, that's what people are going to want to watch. And I guess that's the thing that was shocking to me that didn't happen very much, you know? And it's like, there's obvious reasons why it didn't happen, but you know, well, isn't like he didn't do that, but you know, it feels wrong to me that like he's the athlete. He's not going to go find the camera guy. Like, we'll find the editor, go find the company to represent his thing. At least that's how the understanding felt for me growing up. Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'll take both sides of the argument too, because I think I'm always pushing, you know, I want people to be successful, and sometimes just being upset at the way the status quo is not enough to change it. And I always say, rather than critique something, you have to build a replacement. So, you know, I'm not saying that Sean's post isn't good to get out that conversation, and clearly we're amplifying it here, but I always encourage people to build the change you want to see rather than just complain about it. And I was going to say, Tim, that I've been around a lot of pro climbers doing amazing things, and it blows me away how there is no video, or the video is being taken by their idiot friend on an iPhone, and it just is like gets created with in a very low quality way, which does not tell the story and the amazingness of what went into it. And it was always a shame. And actually, I'll give a little behind the scenes on. I've talked with other people in the climbing industry about doing some management for professional athletes and really making it a one-stop shop, where I understand how athletes just want to be an athlete. They just want to show up, do their thing, try as hard as they can. And when I say do their thing, it's like, it's not just doing their thing. It's climbing some of the most amazing things in the world. Maybe first ascents, maybe it's dangerous. And it's tough for them to coordinate doing all that stuff around it. You know, I'm not saying we're actually doing this business. It's just something that I had talked about with other people, because to me, it's also a shame to have amazing potential for content from some of the best in the world just get lost in the ether because no one was there to capture and tell the story. And just as a shout out, if that is something, if you're a professional climber and you would like to see new ways to be managed and make that connection with brands, send me an email. You know, maybe it's something that I'll put on the back burner. You know, it just seems like a...
Dude, I'll send you an email.
It just seems like a no-brainer. There's all these younger kids too, and people doing amazing things. And it's just like, they don't have the knowledge for how to capture it and amplify that. And if they had a team that could work with brands that and show the brands the value in what these people are doing, and then make them create the content to then return that value back to the brand to then support. You know, you always just want to get that flywheel going. Like, look, yeah. Sean or Tim or some amazing is doing something amazing. Let's support it. Let's tie that to the industry and getting income into the industry and growing the industry so that you can, again, it's that flywheel. Like, how do you start that rolling? But sorry, you can go ahead. That was kind of a tangent for me.
No, no.
Go ahead.
No, I have nothing to say on that. But I know some athletes in climbing that do have managers, and you may be surprised, but they make a lot more money and definitely can stand up for them. Well, the managers can stand up for them a lot better than they, you know, any athlete can stand up for themselves. But it's definitely a needed thing in the climbing industry. And there's, you know, it's that's the weird thing is that there are athletes that succeed in climbing. Like there are athletes that make a pretty good living in climbing, but then there are athletes who maybe, I'm going to be careful with this word. So, you know, don't harp on it too much, but there are athletes that maybe should get paid more. And there are athletes that maybe based on what athletes are getting paid right now, there are athletes definitely in climbing that aren't getting paid at all. But even athletes that are getting paid minimally who should be getting paid more based on what athletes are getting paid a lot.
So then let's get a little brutal and tactical, because this is something I like to do in the podcast when it comes to climbing. And I'll make that analogy is sometimes the world is just brutal. And it's like climbing where, you know, you come up to a climb and you're just like, oh, dude, I wish these holds were bigger. You know, I always complain about little micro razors and how I'm bad at them. And you put me on my style and I'm way better. But, you know, Mandala Sit doesn't care. It just doesn't. Like, it's like, do you want to climb this or not? And I could write it a letter and complain, or I can just adapt myself. Sorry, dude, that was kind of brutal. I'm just kidding. No one's going to read that letter. So my point is that I also want to provide the other side of things for people out there who are pros or aspiring pros, and just be a little brutal, because I want to see you all be successful, because I love this sport and I want to see everyone be successful. And the thing that I think is just really important to understand is that no one will pay you to just climb hard. If you think that just climbing hard is enough, then you're going to be led astray. Now, climbing hard in itself can be transformed into things that are inspiring, into ways to create value for the world. So I'm not saying that climbing hard doesn't have any value. I'm saying that you have to understand that just showing up and ticking things is probably not going to be enough to make a living. And maybe in some sports it might be, but I'm just telling you right now, today in climbing, if you go out and climb a bunch of V16s, it doesn't mean that you're going to be, you know, rich as can be, or be able to even maybe pay your rent. And so I just want to encourage everyone to think about, like, if you take Sean, for example, and I don't know Sean. Actually, Tim, I met Sean like when he was probably like 14 or 15, probably doesn't even remember me, but there's actually a hilarious backstory to that. Sorry, this is a tangent, but it's so good. I met Sean. He was climbing in Squamish on like Black Hole or something. And he was not very good at the time. He was probably like 14. And a friend of mine there made some comment about how if this kid ever gets better than me or climbs harder than me, then I'm going to quit climbing. And like was making fun of, basically he was, did not realize that the up and coming generation is inevitably going to be stronger than we were at that time. And I will not name names, but it's absolutely hilarious because Sean became one of the best climbers of all time. I digress, but you know, if you take someone like Sean as an example, well-spoken, well-written, amazing resume, tons of knowledge under his belt. And I just wish that we could take him and help figure out how to craft a message or create content or offer some product from him that the world valued, so that he got paid for the effort that he's putting into climbing and the knowledge he's acquired along the way. And actually, I will say, Sean, I would be happy to chat with you just to, you know, help you brainstorm on what you can offer, because you have a lot to offer and all these pro climbers have a lot to offer. And we could link this back to that idea earlier about, can't the brands like do more for these climbers to help them realize that potential? And you may be right, and they may be leaving money on the table, but that's not happening. So let's just be honest and let's figure it out, because I want to see people like Sean do well. And you know, I would literally help him. You know, like how can we make someone like that be successful? Cause he does, if you know, deserving it is a weird thing to say, like he deserves to be successful. I would say more, he has the assets and tools available to be successful, and someone needs to figure out a creative and unique way to showcase the excellence that he has in a way that the world values so that he can keep on doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. I guess like where I would feel about it, cause, and thanks for saying that, Josh, I'm sure that'll help a lot of, you know, aspiring professional climbers like myself. And that is super relevant. And I guess, you know, the one more kind of other side of that is someone like Sean not only should be successful, but his success should scale very quickly and easily to what level he is. And I guess like the ways that I would like to see that in the future and the ways that I see that happening in the future are bigger and better sponsorships for sure, better deals, but also like competitions, you know, having competitions grow. And there's an obvious reason why competitions don't pay and why they're not big is because there's not that much money in them and whatnot. And probably the competitions lose a lot of money from, you know, whatever side of the industry is, you know, creating those competitions. But you know, and I have a lot of hope for this in the future. And I have a lot of ideas personally to help make that stuff happen in the future. But that's where I would like to see it happen. You know, I would like to see Sean win a badass comp and get like 25K, 50K for winning that comp, you know, and we all want to watch it. You know, we all want to see him dig to the bone to win that comp. And I'm sure he would. Like, I'm sure that's the type of comp that he would work his ass off for and like actually show up. And that's always what you see is like the more cutthroat a comp is, the more cutthroat the competitors are, you know, and right now there aren't, I don't know, probably anyone who's listening to hear me that can kind of get what I'm trying to get at, but comps are not that fun to watch right now. Like comps are not that sick to watch, and not because the movements aren't cool and not because the holds aren't cool and whatnot, but because the competitors aren't digging to the bone like they are in like, I don't know, a literally like a sport like fighting where you have to fight for your life, you know, and like, but climbing has that aspect to it. And it has had that aspect to it in other comps that I've seen. And it's just not regular. It's not a regular thing. And so how do we generate money in the comps? That's a whole nother crux and whatnot. But that's what I would like to see is, you know, more money in comps, more of the other type of stuff that actually inspires even athletes like Sean with the special things that are about him to actually highlight even more about that and get him paid in that other way. But otherwise, yeah, he can definitely, I like what you're saying, where he can capitalize on the image that he has the tools for, and he has a specific position even as a professional climber to sell himself a lot better. And and I don't know the answers to that, but there's definitely answers there. I guess.
Yeah, some of our creative ideas were how much would you pay to smoke a joint with Chris Sharma?
priceless. It's priceless.
Would you pay? By the way, I may or may not have done that particular thing. I did not pay for
how much did you
anything
pay?
Of that sort. If that was, I, you know, I was going to call. I think it's called green pointing. Right? Is that a term? You can. I think Daniel Woods could be an incredible sommelier at a dinner. He's always. Do you even know what sommelier is, Tim?
No, but I can make context clue to know what that is now.
it's someone who knows wine very well, and he's always,
oh, okay.
I always see Daniel Woods posting a lot about drinking wine, so just yeah, that's
gotcha.
Okay, that's a terrible joke. Anyways, again, I guess the point is I love the idealistic take. I understand it. I really do. But I also want to be here telling some of the hard truths, and you have to recognize just what is available right now for you as a professional climber or as someone who's an up and coming professional. And I think that there's a very big difference between being a professional athlete and an athlete. And this is part of what I'm talking about, where figuring out how to leverage the assets that you have available to you, your knowledge, your platform, to make this a viable lifestyle for you. And like I said, I'm here to help. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish we could just climb our hearts out, be incredible at it, and just inspire those around us and not have to, you know, bring money into the equation exactly, because that's the last thing you're thinking about when you're 50 feet off the deck, you know, doing your hardest moves. Like that's not what it's about. But again, just want to be brutal and realistic. I don't want to be a Pollyanna and telling the hard truths. Yeah,
the conversation is so interesting, and it's important to have that real side. But I like, dude, what you're saying gets me so good. It's, you know, there's a difference between being a professional athlete and being an athlete. And that's where that's just where the pain is, Josh. It's where the pain is as athletes is like, do we want to see professional athletes succeed, or do we want to see athletes succeed? And I guess the obvious thing is, as an athlete, me as an athlete, and I'm trying to be a professional athlete, but I've always felt like an athlete, you know, and I'm only being a professional athlete because it's the smart thing to do. But I would like to see athletes succeed more than professional athletes, a lot more than professional athletes. And some athletes succeed a lot more than some professional athletes, but most athletes don't. And most athletes don't succeed at all. And so, like, in the world and, you know, financially. And so that's just a cold hard truth. I, you know, hopefully that was interesting for you guys to kind of hear the insights and the thoughts and the realistic ideas and the idealistic ideas. But, you know, it was a huge post, and, you know, it definitely struck the world a bit, I think, in a good way.
Yeah. Thanks for putting that out there, Sean. I'll say it again. I just thought it was extremely well written. If you haven't checked it out, we definitely summarized it and then some, but I'll put a link in the show notes for everyone to check it out. And yeah, I'm just going to say it again. I'm here to help and help people figure it out. I may not like the cold, hard truth, but you got to be practical in some sense. And maybe that just comes from being old and getting your ass kicked by the world time and time again, even when you think it should be a different way, because that's what the world does to you. So yeah. All right, Tim, holy crap. Was that what our podcast was about, or was that just our beginning part? But it was, I find that whole conversation interesting, and it is part of elite climbing, because if you're an elite climber, you're dealing with this stuff. And you know, maybe someday we'll get Sean on here to tell his side of the story. And actually, I hope if he ever does come on here, he'll just be balling out by the time he comes in here, because he'll have figured it out or the brands will recognize his value. Seriously, nothing would make me happier. Seriously.
Me too.
Okay. Got some announcements, because I don't want to talk about any more latest news. Other than, I'm just going to say, Dave Graham did a new V16. Go watch it. It's on Mellow. He's just a fucking wizard, dude. It's just knee bars so and sequencing and just wizardry at its finest. So go check it out. Just incredible. And Tim, not a ton of announcements. We did our last classroom. It was just such a banger. I don't know, just really good. I feel like we're hitting the flow, just loving it. And, you know, yeah, just wanted to say thank you to all those people who were in there, and just anyone out there, we'd love to have you in there too. It's really fun. And you can join us by going on Patreon. It'll be in our show notes too. And if that is not something you're interested in, but you still want to support us, we do have a $5 tier that is kind of our lower tier. And we have a bunch of supporters there, but we just took a hard look at it and realized that we're not doing enough to support to give back to our supporters there. And so we're trying to come up with something for that tier that, you know, is a thank you. And, you know, if anyone out there has ideas, you know, we're open to it. We just want it to be sustainable so that we can, you know, fit it into our schedules, but also that's valuable to you guys. So, you know, we were thinking maybe like a top five Q&A where people send in a bunch of questions and we pick really five cool ones. And me and Tim just do a asynchronous kind of podcast where we answer those five top questions. They could be video analysis. So, you know, people send in videos of themselves climbing and we break them down. We could do extra podcast content that's only available to patrons. You know, maybe just from our guests, or a collection of all the pro tips from each past episode, all in one place where we dive deep on each one. Yeah, just open to ideas, because really we just appreciate everyone's support and we want to make sure that we're holding up our end of the bargain. We're professionals.
I want to make one note
for it, Tim.
I want to make one note on the classrooms, because for one, man, the last one was my favorite one. But for two, I think it's a missed opportunity for you guys, to be honest. You know, I'm just, if you guys want any sort of like form of coaching or like conversation, we answer, I think, everybody's questions in there, and we almost always stay after. And, you know, because we say it's an hour and now Josh made it an hour and a half, and like basically we're hanging out in there. It's an intimate environment. It's been 2.5 hours. Josh stayed like an hour extra that one time too. And man, it's so good, dude. Like the questions that people ask are shocking to me. Like it's surprisingly so, so good. And it's just a good environment to like go back and forth. And, you know, it's a totally different approach to coaching and like classroom type feel that than I've ever seen in climbing. But I find it, and I don't know, I mean, you know, maybe we can hear from the people who have been in the classrooms too, but they keep coming back and, you know, they keep coming back with more questions. So it's a good sign for me that they like it and it's good. So it's only $25 a month to support us, but honestly, that's for us, that's great and that's huge. But the classroom is really where an opportunity. If I was a younger athlete and I could see that, I would do it, man. Like it's good. It's really cool. Like, and I just enjoy doing it. And I do this for fun too. You know, the classroom is awesome. Like I love that classroom. So
there you go. Ringing endorsement from Tim. I think the reason that we stay longer is that when we have people who are there and psyched and supporting us, like how could we not stay and answer their questions? Like it's yeah. To me, that is part of holding up our end of the bargain, is just making sure that they get their questions answered, because, and they're good questions. So,
yeah.
Okay, Tim, roundabout way of getting to our topic of the day, which is that the seasons have changed, man. It's cold. Like I said, we're in long johns, drinking hot coffee and getting psyched because it's just cold. And I'm ready for some outdoor climbing, but I'm soft, Tim. I've been on the lake drinking beer, not climbing hard. And then you get your, knuckles raked on hard granite and you're bloody and it's miserable out there. And you're like, this is fun. Like I like this. Right. And then those projects feel hard. So yeah, I wanted to describe the process that I've been going through to shifting into outdoor mode. And because for many, it really is a big switch. Some people maybe have the luxury of living in a place where there's year round climbing outdoors, but likely you've been in the gym all summer, maybe you've been going outside like a little bit, but it's hot. You're just not even really sending. And, maybe you have a trip planned for the winter. We do that a lot over, some kind of Christmas break or something. So I think the point is what do we do to prepare ourselves for this season? And how do we make sure that we have a successful season coming up? Because you get these big goals. You've been watching those Mello videos. You've been getting psyched. You have your project picked out, and we want to help you make sure that you have a chance at sending your hardest. So I think that the way I wanted to start digging into this topic is just looking at what the big differences are outside compared to inside. And the one that really stands out to me is just the technical requirements. It's so different. It's just, if you've been on the moon board or in the gym, there's just a different type of movement associated with outdoor climbing. It's both more static and more dynamic. Like you always have to really slow down that position, but then oftentimes you have to go just a little bit further than you want to. Like, or at least for me, that's what it seems like outdoors is, no one set that route to make it just super comfy. It's like always an extra inch further than you want to throw. And there's also usually typically smaller handholds and footholds. So it's more finger intensive. And we're dealing with skin management because rock is so sharp. You've got logistics to deal with. And I think one of the other things that I wanted to point out is how different the season is when it comes to volume management. And not volumes like you bolt onto the wall, but just the amount of climbing that you partake in, because outdoor climbing is much less volume than indoor climbing, or at least the way I do it. And that's something that you really need to recognize. So I wanted to just start out by just pointing out why is winter outdoor climbing different than summer gym climbing? And then we can kind of break those down as to how to address them and get you prepared to get outside and send.
Nice. I definitely have some thoughts here. And the why outdoor climbing is different, or in this case we're talking about it being more difficult, because sometimes indoor climbing is more difficult, and that's why I kind of have specialized my coaching in towards like movement specifically, because that's where the indoor cruxes are like specifically movements and hold types and whatnot, and that's highlighted. But it's also highlight outdoors as well, of course, but outdoors highlights other difficult factors that make climbing pretty difficult. And for me, actually, the biggest ones are that technical aspect that you're talking about, because outdoor climbing is more deeply technical on specific types of techniques and movements, and there's a lot more variability for lots of climbs, especially in that opportunity for technique will shine more when you have more opportunities on the rock. And pain is definitely a huge part of this climbing experience outdoors. And so I kind of share a perspective that I've had, two different perspectives that I'll have. One was a conversation that came up very recently about Sleepwalker. And Michaela, my girlfriend, who's been climbing for 2 years, and she's about to send her first V10, which is awesome. She's really close to sending Americana Exotica, which is awesome. She kind of made a comment on my first session of Sleepwalker. I did all the moves and I was looking pretty good on it, and I thought I could honestly send it very quickly. And then my second session, I was a little bit more tired, but still felt pretty good and looked really good. And she was like, oh, you should just rest until the temps are good. And I was like, no, I think I'm going to go in session again, like when it's bad temperatures and before I'm fresh and stuff, because there's a couple of links where I want to get better. And then I got there and I was like, you know what, babe, like here's the really interesting reason why I'm here. It's hard to climb on this thing. It's just hard on my body. It's just like, it hurts. It's just hard on my body. And climbing in the gym doesn't do that for me. Like I just have to climb on this thing. And by the time I feel in shape to then focus on the climb, you know, by beating myself up on this climb, then I hope the temperatures are good. And so basically I had two sessions recently where the temperatures were pretty horrible and the conditions were really bad too. They were really like just sweaty and whatnot. And I could have just left, you know, 30 minutes, an hour into the session knowing that I wouldn't have sent the climb, but I kept pulling on and trying to make links and like trying to feel the severity. Basically this climb specifically is, it's hard on your skin for sure. Like the right hand gets absolutely messed up. It's just a lot of like slapping and sliding and you just lose skin every time, but it's also brutal on the back and the underclings. And this climb specifically, I wanted to just train and get my body robust for that. That's one aspect of outdoor climbing that's huge. And so obviously for sleepwalkers specifically, that's a very specific type of beating up that I needed to get used to. But I do the same thing in other areas, and I'll kind of explain another tactic that I used to use a lot when I go to new areas. And so specifically, this will go back to another kind of, you know, zoomed out question, which is, what do you want to do in the climbing trip that you have? You know, are you going to try to do a bunch of classics? Are you going to try to sample, you know, a bunch of new climbs? Are you going to pick, you know, 10 different projects to try over a week? Or are you just going to try the one that you, you know, you go back to this area that you've gone to for a long time, you're just going to dedicate to this one climb, because it's also a different approach. But in general, you know, what I like to do in areas is I like to get a lot of volume, because for me, learning how to climb on a specific rock type, on a specific movement type, the best way is significant not only for my climbing, but it's significant to teach my body and get my body used to that type of climbing. For example, in Bishop, very footwork heavy place. It's very, you know, it's sharp and there's obvious edges and whatnot. But honestly, if you want to succeed on moderate level climbing there, you need to have amazing footwork and you need to have a very type of, you have to have a type of footwork where it doesn't tax your hands, right? And so that allows me to have a ton more volume. So what I do every time I go to Bishop is I do a whole circuit of warmups that I've done many, 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 many times in the past. Because I'm able to do these climbs well, because I've done them so many times, and when I did them the first times, I knew exactly how to do them, I'm able to go on and not tax my skin, but get my skin touching the rock and pulling. And I really like touching the rock, pulling on the rock, impacting the rock in a controlled way. But you know, you can see the very first time I went to Bishop, I think I tried this V4 or whatever to the left of Sheep Herder. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, Josh. And it's just horribly sharp.
Oh,
and
yeah. Super, I used to sharp think, arete, right?
Dude,
yeah.
It's like the one to the right of the arete where it's like all these just pure crimps on the face. It's like the birthday boulders, and then behind you is Sheep Herder, and then just to the left of Sheep Herder, there's this face that's just like horrible crimps. And it says V4 in the book, or maybe even softer now. And you know, my traditional approach to warming up is following the grades and like climbing up the grades. And of course, what I did my first trip is, you know, I tried the birthday boulder stuff and that stuff was really, really hard. And then, you know, I did a couple V2s and I hopped on that V4 and it ruined my skin, because the way that you climb this V4 was really thrutchy. There was not really like good footwork available to you to like find it, or at least I couldn't find it. And I just ended up ruining my skin. It started stinging for the day, and that day was pretty bad. And the next couple days I came in, I just repeated the ones that I thought were a bit more mellow for me. And even some of them were harder grades. For example, like for me, High Plains Drifter is a better warm-up than like the Hunk. And the Hunk's a V2. And High Plains Drifter is V7. Because I can climb High Plains Drifter with pretty good technique and I can grab the holds how I want to. But the Hunk, I'm like, as soon as I pull on, I'm just full bone crimping, like bearing down, like, oh, like horrible warm-up, you know? And obviously I've also learned how to climb on the Hunk a little bit better and, you know, warm up on that a bit better. But that's the kind of point there, is that you could teach yourself to use specific climbs to warm up a bit better outside. And that warm-up process for me sometimes is a couple of days. It depends how many days I've done in the season, Josh. Like, it really depends. If it's my first couple days out in the season, I am not pulling on the hardest stuff for sure, unless I've already done that for the past couple of weeks. I usually go out and I do quite a bit of volume on rock, especially Bishop type rock, because it's sharp and it just gets my skin going. And then, well, after one day, or nowadays it's pretty quick. Nowadays my skin adapts pretty quickly, but for me, after a couple of hours, I'm like, oh, well, now my skin doesn't hurt because I've picked good climbs that I can climb good on, but my skin is adapted. It's got that harder callus we were kind of obsessing about in the beginning of this podcast, where I can find the indents in my skin. I'm like, wow, this is fantastic, you know? That's kind of what I thought about.
Don't you love when you're just tapping your desk and it's like that hard sounding thing? It doesn't even sound.
I love rubbing my hands together. Yeah. It's like, yeah. And it's not good right now.
No, you're a really good skin farmer. Yeah, you know how to grow it. Well, dude, I'm just going to piggyback on that, because that was my first note when it came to these technique requirements, is if possible, just get out and start doing mileage on easier stuff of all the different terrain available to you outdoors. And I just focus on climbing super smoothly, making it feel fluid and good, not like just doing it right, but just trying to do it beautifully and super, super, make it as easy as possible. Cause I just find when I've been in the gym too much, especially on boards, I'm just jumpy, man. Like I just kind of lurched to everything. I just go dynamic versus this kind of smooth control, even weight on the feet. It's like, no, I'm jumping to this hold. And even I say jumping as in it might sound like a dyno, but more just jumping as in kind of throwing myself between each hold, like a monkey going between branches versus like this smooth controlled, slot, style. And yeah, I would say that goes right into my other note about your skin and just do not wreck your skin on the first day of your trip or even your weekend. Like if this is your first time outdoors for the season and you just get a bunch of flappers and splits, like they may never really recover for the entire season. Like you might be managing it week after week after week. And it's just recognize that you have to build your skin, like you were saying, and that if you go and warm up on something crazy sharp and you do it with crappy footwork, then you're going to wreck your skin, dude. And it's going to ruin your day. It's going to ruin your next day. And this is why I sometimes do antihydral, because I'm sweaty. And if you're sweaty, you lose a lot more skin. But if you split, do not use antihydral, because you'll just split more. And, you know, like we were saying, your skin quality actually has a big determination on how easy or hard a climb is. You know, we're talking about that with calluses and having it dig into you. And, you know, just doing this lets you recognize and understand that there is something painful about climbing outdoors on miserable micro crimps. Like you have to get okay with that. And then you'll find that you know that things are going well when your mind starts grabbing these slopers or crystals or crimps and it starts digging in and you're like, oh yeah, right there. And it feels good. Instead of it being like, ow, I can't focus on the climbing, you make this mental shift and actually a physical shift with your skin where it actually feels good to have those crystals dig in. And I also just want to point out that one of the ways to save skin is do not fall. Like, look, okay, you're going to fall. That's my pro tip, guys. When you're climbing, just don't fall. That's how you send. No, it's not quite like that. It's that if you want to save your skin, recognize when to try hard and when to not try hard. Like if you pop off a hold, you lose a ton of skin. If you slap a hold and then just cheese grater off, you lose a bunch of skin. And so we've talked about this a bunch, Tim, where when you're working a move, like make your tries count. Like understand when all you're doing is kind of pulling on, getting into position and kind of doing the movement and then slapping the hold and not even trying to hold it versus like, okay, now is a send go. Like now I'm going to try to grab this hold and just being cognizant that skin is a big part of climbing outdoors, way more so than indoors.
Dude, you made a couple of really good points there, and I'm going to try to remember them as I highlight them. But one point that you're making about kind of the feeling, I just want to echo like the feeling of when you get good skin and you can like know what a hold can do for you versus as a big versus there, you know, versus focusing on the pain of it, because I've been there too. And I'm like, dude, wait, I can't even focus on the moves. I can't even focus on like when this friction is good and whatnot. But highballing for me is very much like that. And maybe that's why I like highballing, because the intensity is inherently lower on a lot of highballs, or it becomes lower because you spend so much time focusing on how to do these moves the easiest way. And then what you do end up focusing on in the goes is kind of like the feeling of the texture and the grit and the footwork. And like, if you really can't feel that stuff, you probably shouldn't be highballing. It's like a big thing, you know, and like, it'll take me a while to get to that moment where I'm like, basically for me, taking the rope off is when I can feel those things. That's actually a huge component there is like, can I feel the holds? Can I feel the footwork? Can I feel the holds with my feet? And if I can't, then why would I take the rope off? Because how am I going to control everything, right? Because I obviously can control these other factors that we've talked about on the podcast a lot, which is the mechanics and those types of things. But that can only take you so far outside. You know, at a certain point, you have to feel the friction and feel when you're going to fall or not based on the friction, because that's another component that happens a lot less indoors. You're making another point about style, which is really cool. Like when you're climbing on the board a lot, you kind of inherently your body bias is a style that's successful, right? Like, because in order to succeed on the board, you have to jump around and get really aggressive. But in order to succeed outside, you can do that, but that's wasteful and all these things. And you can do something else that's far more efficient, far more beautiful, and far more elegant, and use your feet a lot better outside because there's more options, there's more friction, there's more texture, and, you know, in different ways. And there's more like available leverage, I would argue, on a lot of different positions outside than on the moon board specifically. Sometimes the best thing to do on the moon board is to jump and pull. But isn't that why we've podcasted on the moon board and why it's a good, effective tool? It's for that reason. It's not to get better at climbing. It's to get better at trying, you know, to get better at trying hard. And I guess one point that I want to make there that Nate and I were talking about last night was know the difference between, or I think Mikhail and I were talking about this actually, know the difference between training and getting better. Right. Know that, and sometimes that can be done in climbing both ways. You can have a climbing session and train. You can have a climbing session and get better at climbing. And I guess when you go outside, you know, you're probably rarely training, like unless you're me trying to set up for like a big, you know, high ball link up attempt or something. And even that, I was focusing on climbing well as part of my training. Because I did an absurd amount of volume, an absurd amount of mileage, you know, right before I did the link up. And a lot of that was training. And that was the first time I went to Bishop to train, of course. But for the most part, you're working on how to get better at climbing. And I personally think that you can spend most of your time in the gym training. And then as long as you remind yourself when you go outside, like, hey, I got to climb better now. And I think you can have a better session. So definitely a good point to make there. Well, Josh is saying it for himself. That's what he has to do. But I think everybody should do that. You know, everybody should go and know the difference between board climbing, gym climbing, and then outdoor climbing. And honestly, this is the thing that I used to tell like team kids sometimes too. I'm like, well, if you're going outdoor climbing, you're going to somehow climb a lot better, or you're going to go to a comp and somehow climb a lot better. If you're going to choose to do like a mock round, if you're going to choose to try a new set, if you're going to try to try your project indoors, shift the mindset to outdoor climbing indoors as well. And so it's kind of a double-sided pro tip there where, like, obviously when we're taking it outside, you know, turn the mindset outdoors. But when you're inside sometimes, maybe you want to turn the mindset kind of outdoors. But interesting points.
I see what you did there. Yeah, yeah. On that, just again, that difference of outdoor climbing and what you might be exposed to compared to indoor climbing, it really is going to be more fingery, almost certainly if you're going outdoors to boulder hard. Now, I could make a bunch of arguments about different places or sport climbing where this may not be true, but I think it's a reasonable thing that you're probably going to encounter more finger intensive climbing outdoors, also because often the feet are smaller, and so we put less weight on our feet outdoors than indoors. Again, upping that kind of finger intensive aspect. So what do you do about that? It's really important to expose yourself to the smaller holds before you go out and then just go a muerte on your project, right? Like, it's like, okay, I haven't full crimped in 6 months and now I'm going to try to full crimp as hard as I can on this 6 mil, you know, like, and over and over and over again. And that's why people get injured, is because they just, there's a range of motion that they're not used to in full crimping. There's a try hard that they typically haven't exhibited either in the gym at all, like you're saying, where they're not like having that performance oriented session sometimes. But then also, just when was the last time that the crux on your indoor project was, a 6 mil edge where you had to lock it off, right? So I'm a big fan of just exposure to these positions in a controlled environment, aka the hangboard or training, before you show up and do a really hard move and you know, bust your pulley because you haven't full crimped. So I want to separate this from the idea of going on a hangboard and training to get stronger. Those can go hand in hand. If you are actually like, okay, I know I have this trip coming up, I'm going to train my fingers to get used to full crimping or get my fingers stronger for this upcoming trip to XYZ area that's fingery, that will also serve the purpose of just getting exposure to that specific grip type and hopefully reducing the chance of injury. Although I just want to flag, be careful training something really hard and then taking 2 days off and then going and maxing out like that. That's, you know, the amount of volume that you are involving in a specific grip type is one of the most common predictors for injury. But on the other side, no volume in that specific type of movement is a predictor for injury too. So I like to do this thing where as I get closer, I just use full crimps on my hangboard as like a, almost like a warm up, because the full crimp is, you know, requires you to have this hyperextended first joint. I think it's like the PIP joint. It's just, it's kind of extreme ranges of motion. And so if you just do it once a day, or, you know, once every couple of days, again, not to like build strength, but just to tell your tissues and body, like, hey, I'm used to this. I know this. And you can do this with drop knees or something too, right? You could just go in and out of deep internal rotation. Just showing your body, kind of greasing that groove. Like, this is a move that we're going to see, you know, get used to it, and not necessarily do it for strength. And I do that. So if I know I'm going to be in Bishop dynoing to full crimps or pulling really hard in full crimps that are small, I'm going to take the time to just expose myself to that type of extreme range of motion and tension before actually going. So, you know, pockets are a class one for this too, drop knees, but that could be a pro tip in itself. Just make sure that you expose your fingers to extreme full crimping before you go out in the winter and do crux full crimping moves. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's, I'm going to double. This is a good one. I think this is maybe one of the more immediate ones that people will think about when it comes to like, oh, I'm going to go outside, I maybe should full crimp more, and then maybe kind of just, yeah, blow it, you know? And so I think Josh's kind of approach to introducing full crimping into your climbing is probably the best way to do it. But I kind of want to go over an understanding of the difference between like having full crimping and then like the training of the fingers, because it's something that like kind of shocked me as I was growing. And this is a little bit more scientific, but still not, I don't know the science behind this. So, and I don't think most coaches or PTs know the science necessarily behind it. We're learning science in fingers and whatnot, but we know the science of like the exposure over long periods of time of full crimping. And, you know, because there's so many levels to crimping. And, you know, even hearing like Dave Fitzgerald talk about it on a previous podcast, and his approach to training fingers makes a lot of sense. You know, there's a lot of like levels to crimping, and hearing you talk about it makes a lot of sense too. And the way that I formed it in my head is there's a difference between recruitment from your fingers and there's a difference between stimulus for your fingers. And recruitment for your fingers is where I think a lot of people get confused. It's also why Josh and I are really notorious climbers for being pretty strong climbers, climbing pretty hard and lots of grades and whatnot, but we always say we have weak fingers. You know, we're pretty rare in that way. You know, I think a lot of climbers who do end up climbing strong inevitably say the opposite, where my fingers are super, super strong, but my body's not as strong, right? You literally have like two different classes of climbers, and kids coming up nowadays are pretty good at both, you know, and it's like, obviously it's important to have both. And so when I introduce fingers, you know, obviously since I was young, because I'm saying I have, you know, quote unquote weak fingers, it's because my recruitment is really high. My recruitment ability on most holds in like the 15 mil plus range, you know, so 15 mil being this for me, a pretty small hold, which is very shocking. Not right now, not so much, because I'm training this other side for the last maybe 2 years. And, you know, now I finally feel comfortable hanging like 6 mils, 8 mils, 10 mils and stuff. Finally, literally, you know, after climbing V13 plus when I was like, you know, 5-6 years ago, I couldn't hang a 6 millimeter. And so nowadays I can, just because I'm exposing it over time, literally. And that's the stimulus side. So the recruitment side is training and hanging on a decent edge, but training your ability to pull on the edge. And that's a lot of climbing, especially in the gym. You know, a lot of climbing in the gym is being able to pull on a decently small hold. But as soon as that PIP joint is kind of hyperextended or engaged really hard, you lose that recruitment ability, right? But it can scale. If you can get that stimulus higher, where you can get more comfortable turning a high flexion crimp where that PIP joint is, you know, engaged, or the, even for example, from an open hand position to a half crimp position, that's still more engagement, right? And so for me, actually, when I was really young, my open hand three finger drag was really, really, really strong because my recruitment ability and my maneuverability on the wall was pretty good, but I couldn't half crimp at all because I never did. And I literally just started half crimping, but then I was still training the recruitment side throughout that, and I was getting better at both. And I did the exact same thing with full crimping the last couple of years. I full crimp more often. And actually, I love what Josh is saying, where you should probably just do it on the hangboard. For me, I actually just do that with my feet on the ground still. I'll go to the moon board and I'll just start full crimping holds with my street shoes on and just start yarding on it, kind of, you know, and just pulling on, being like, ooh, interesting. Like, not hard necessarily, but like hard enough to feel that full crimping gauge. And then in my warm-ups, I'm actually full crimping more often than I am in my session, you know, because again, it's a more controlled environment and I can just do more of it, right? And so I think the big thing here is that because full crimping is so difficult, you probably, even if you start introducing in your sessions, won't be able to do it very much without feeling like you're going to get hurt. So do it more often. How are you going to do that more often? You got to do it easier. You probably just have to do it easier, more controlled movements, you know, maybe even on vert is where you're going to see it a lot more often. But taking that to a point that Josh made previously, you're just going to full crimp more often outside. There's just smaller holds. There's way worse feet. And so I wanted not necessarily to echo that, what you're saying, but answer the other side of that, which is the feet. And kind of Josh was saying that feet are smaller, therefore they're harder to use. And I actually kind of agree with that, but also disagree with it. Another approach to that, just the same as we're tackling full crimping, is training on smaller feet. You know, you can do that in the gym. And understanding why smaller feet are more difficult, it's because we don't trust them. And so it's not necessarily that they can do less. I've been proven many, many, many times that small feet can do just as much as bigger footholds and whatnot. We just don't trust them. And so for me, my ankles will wobble a bit, you know, like just kind of jump off the smaller feet a lot of the time versus stay on them. But a lot of times that I do try to stay on smaller feet, they stay. A lot of times that I try to use a little bit more on smaller feet, it works. It gives me a little bit more. And so that's the point there. Start trying to use more. Start trying to expose smaller feet. I love gyms that introduce those really small, like Technic jibs or those new flat hold jibs or the cheetah jibs, you know, all these screw on jib footholds that are a lot smaller. You know, the biggest crux that I find in gyms is a big call out to route setters out there. Like, you should use smaller feet when the feet can be emphasized in the movement. We should know the difference between what a foothold should be able to do for the move and what it shouldn't be able to do for a move. And so in that same token, it's fine to have, you know, obnoxiously large feet on movements where maybe the foot movement isn't highlighted. Maybe that's not necessarily the highlight of the movement, but when foot mechanics are highlighted movements, make it as small as possible. Make it as small as possible. This is a call out for a route setter. Or if you're going to create boulders on a spray wall, for example, that maybe has jibs, and maybe those are the only jibs you're going to find in your gym are on the spray wall, find ways to do that. So here's another tip. If you don't have that, if you don't have jibs in your gym, you can't find makeup boulders and whatnot, this is what we used to do on team. We would put pennies. We would traverse the rope walls because it's all low angle stuff. And we would put pennies on whole footholds. And basically, if you knocked it off, you would just start over. There was no like real winning to this game. It was just a drill. It was just a practice drill. We just put pennies on these footholds and it would make the edge small and make it really small, but you had to get across the wall and you also just weren't allowed to campus. Like the goal with this would
wait,
be
so
to...
Did you stand on the penny or did you...
No.
Or did you use the penny to you make just, the foothold smaller?
You make the foothold smaller, but also more delicate, right? So you have to actually use it. And so you could use it. You know, just put some pennies on footholds and you can even barely balance on some slopey ones where it's like, oh, dude, if anything touches that, that thing's going to come off. And you start getting way more precarious with your footwork. You get more engaged with your footwork. And that was one really, really small drill that we used. But, you know, on top of that drill... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just laughing because Tim, like you're dated. And, like no one has change anymore. Like no one has pennies laying around. Like,
oh, shit. Yeah, dude. Wait. Where are you gonna find pennies?
Here's my challenge for that is if you're in California, go do Funky Tut. It's a V3,
dude.
On it's like incredible V3.
So hard.
I'm gonna say it's. I think it's a test piece. Like I, it's not like the most majestic giant boulder, but it has this movement that just, you know, stands the test of time. You have to rock over onto this. I don't even know if it's a penny, it might be a dime sized edge, and it just works. You can just stand on it, but it's kind of far away from you too. It's a little out to the side and you have to rock over and commit to it. And it's just terrifying. It was a really big thing for me to do it. Like it sounds dumb, but this was my first, you know, like 15 years ago, I was just like, I'm supposed to stand on this? Or you could just climb anything in Yosemite. Just literally anything in Yosemite is like that. And I want to point out that I had that whole rant on the last one about cheating indoors. And I got a bunch of positive comments about my rant too. So I'm glad that I'm glad I ranted. But then since then, someone made a comment on the post that the rant was in reference to, the Instagram post about cheating indoors. And they said, oh yeah, because there's bolt holes outdoors too. And why I think it's hilarious is they're kind of making fun of me for saying use bolt holes for feet. But actually, that is kind of what outdoors is like. There are bolt holes everywhere. There is pebbles. You can stand on freaking anything outdoors. And so I just wanted to, rant number two is, yeah, there basically are bolt holes outdoors. You can stand on anything outdoors. And I really like what you did, Tim, where you took my thing focusing on small handholds and you focused on the small footholds, because that's, well, half the battle.
Yeah. It's a justification that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think a lot of climbers probably will, for example, those climbers who are kind of like making fun of you, they can't see those bolt holes, dude. They can't see them. So they need to increase their finger strength, right? But they also should be able to see the bolt holes, right? You watch any strong climber out there, you know, trying to find their feet, they're stepping on things that are just horrendous, you know, and I'll watch strong climbers kind of like deviate on the go, you know, like they'll do the climbing improv where, you know, they're doing their project or whatever, and they're like topping out and they're like get to the section where they don't know and they find new feet. And I'll be like, wait, I'll like walk up and be like, What did you step on? Your foot didn't slip, but what were you stepping on? It's always something horrible. And I love that. I actually have a pro tip. And the pro tip, it goes hand in hand what we're talking about right now. Have a soft shoe and a stiff shoe. This is just the pro tip, and I'll explain why it applies here. But having a soft shoe and a stiff shoe is pretty important. I mean specifically for the outdoors, but for the indoors as well. I actually almost never use a stiff shoe indoors for a reason that I am kind of trying to hint at for training your footwork, because you can't feel the feet very much when they're too stiff. And I do make a caveat here. Having a soft shoe and a stiff shoe is not having a new shoe and an old shoe. Okay, it's very different things. There are shoes out there nowadays that are specifically softer shoes. I wear La Sportiva Theories for competitions because they're a softer shoe, but I actually will have them brand new because the only difference between them being new and old is the edge starts to round. And so in comps, the suppleness of the rubber is still soft, meaning I can flex my toes and feel them on footholds and on movements still pretty well, even when they're a brand new shoe, but they have an edge. And so if I was to go on Funky Tut, I could put a Theory on as long as it was, you know, within probably a week's worth of using it, probably within more likely like 50 attempts of the shoe usage. I look at more of attempts than how long I've had the shoe for, because I'll have shoes too, because I'm sponsored, obviously. I can have like more shoes, obviously. So I have the luxury here to, you know, pick and choose when I use a shoe and like don't have to retire. I can retire a shoe very early. And I do that because I know when I want my shoes to be very specific. But a high level pro tip, and especially if you can afford it, know when your shoes, what life your shoes have for like what type of climbing you have. And for example, I can get on Funky Tut, which is, by the way, a V3, I think. Is that the V3 version?
I think so.
In Bishop. And there's many test pieces in Bishop that are V3 and under, like actual test pieces that almost certainly I'll take any of you listeners over there and you won't flash them. And they're amazing test pieces. And I've taken my mom to them and she's flashed an embarrassing amount of them for me. she's flashed like Robinson. She's flashed sheep herder. Like, I don't know how she's flashing these things. But most people wouldn't do that. And anyway, I could take a brand new Theory to Funky Tut, and that foothold is horrible, but I would definitely rather use that than even a solution, because it's just about the edge there. It's all about the edge for me. But then also I want that softer shoe to feel that flex, because basically every time I have done Funky Tut, I basically step on that foot, go, and then I just put probably 80% more weight onto my hands because I'm like, ah, the foothold's gonna blow, and then I just pull out of it, right? And we don't want to do that. Like, it's just what happens, but we want to kind of clean that up over time. And I'll try to push myself to do it again. And I actually usually end up not being able to do it because I try to put more weight on that foot and the foot starts to like burr my rubber and just like, you know, I start to fall or whatnot. But the point there is that we're here to practice, right, guys? Like, you want to get better at this. It's not necessarily to say the reality of like, well, you're going to go and you're going to feel like whatever and it's going to be hard. But when it does feel hard, here's what you're supposed to focus on. If you have a softer shoe, and even especially if it's a newer shoe, focus on what your shoe can do, right? Focus on what your shoe can do for you. We don't want our shoes just to be like, well, I hope that stays. I hope that's going to do enough for me. No. You have to direct your feet and you have to direct your shoes. And we've talked about this on so many different episodes of the podcast, but honestly, it applies the most, in my opinion, to outdoor climbing, because outdoor climbing is the most difficult, at least for me, you know, like, and I practice footwork so much on, you know, indoor climbing in the boards, in the gym, on certain projects outdoors, but outdoors becomes so difficult for me to be like, man, I can't trust my feet for the duration of climbing movements. You know, I'll just start jumping off things or kind of wanting to get off of my feet. But having those different shoes, you'll start to know there's a difference between what shoes can do for you and what they can't do for you, for et cetera. And then you start to pay attention to like, man, I'm not using my feet, aren't I? Like, I'm not using my hips. I'm not using my knees. I'm not keeping my toe flexed. I'm not keeping the foot on for as long as I can.
I love that new shoe edge, dude. I just love taking out some freshies and just having, I do not agree with the idea of using theories on Funky Tut, though. I think that is insane. I would definitely prefer a brand new solution. I know what you're saying, though, if it has that edge, but I love those stiff midsoles when you have the really tiny edges. And I do think it's interesting to say, have a stiff shoe and have a soft shoe and know why and when to switch them up. And I will say that in general, you're probably going to like stiffer shoes outdoors than indoors. Just that's like a real broad brush there, but just something to think about. And I also think that it's funny how people retire shoes because they have a hole in them versus because they've lost the edge. And solutions will last me forever. If I didn't retire them just because I got tired of the rounded edge, I could just wear them forever. They never get holes in them. And then I think that they're fine. And then I get a new pair and I put them on and I start stepping on things. I just think it's the best thing ever. I love a brand new fresh edge. So yeah, I just think it's nice to know when to retire shoes. You know, there's a monetary component there. So I don't want to just say, yeah, like use new shoes every session. Like that would be great. And that's not a reality, but one way to do that is I usually do have what I'll call send shoes, or at the very least, climbing on hard climb shoes. So I often warm up in an old pair of shoes because I just want to save my edge for my hardest climbs. And some people, if you really want to take it to the next level, maybe you have a bigger pair that you can wear socks in so you can just kind of cruise around and not be in pain when you first start. So anyways, that's just a little side pro tip. But I just, before it gets lost, we were talking about footwork and we got on that off of small hands, and you made a comment about exposing yourself to crimping. And I really liked that comment you made about grabbing it while your feet are still on the ground. And I think that actually highlights best what I was saying about just doing full crimping as a way to get your body used to it and not necessarily as a strengthening exercise. Again, I'm not saying you can't use full crimping and hangboarding to get stronger. I'm saying that that is one thing. And another thing is just getting used to that range of motion. So when I would do my normal shoulder warm-ups and just kind of dicking around, not doing some hangboard session, I would still walk up to the hangboard, get into a full crimp on the 8 mils. I'm not lifting my feet off the ground. I'm just getting that range of motion. And you can take that same thought process into drop knees, pockets, or whatever. So I just wanted to highlight that because I think that's really smart and cool. And then along the lines of the next things that you deal with outdoors, it's just logistically different. you get a nice latte next door, roll in, buy some new chalk, sit down in a warm place and, you know, find your buddies there. It's just, it'll be cold. You might have to hike really far. And you need to recognize that it's a very different style than rolling into a gym. And so you want to get your setup dialed. You want to have warm layers. You want to have layers. You want to make sure that you've got a good pad setup. So if you have to hike in, you know, half an hour or an hour, that you're not just wrecked when you show up and your shoulders hurt. And, you know, you just, there's all these things that go along with showing up and doing your best that is not, does not happen in the gym. And something we talked about earlier too was this idea that you might have to session at night for temps or in the morning because that's when your project is going to be in the shade versus the sun. Like whatever it may be, you're probably going to find yourself climbing at a weird time, maybe when you don't want to, right? Like that's, in fact, I feel like that just is one of this big fundamental differences between being outdoors and indoors, is that those crimps are a little smaller than you want them to be. Those foot chips are a little smaller than you want them to be. That heel hook is just a little more awkward than you want it to be. And that's part of adjusting, is just everything is, well, it was not set with you in mind. It just is. You know, it's the boulder is where it is. The boulder gets in the sun or the shade when it does, and those holds are just the way they are. And just doing everything you can to optimize it so that you make as comfortable and yourself as prepared as you can be, but then still have that mental attitude of, yeah, but it's going to be a little sharper than I want, or whatever the case may be. And that's where that ritual also came to mind, is how do you get yourself psyched up if it's too cold? How do you get yourself psyched up if it's 6 in the morning instead of when you climb at 6 at night? What do you do? And having that ritual, having that gear to make it as comfortable as possible, and then having that mindset that, yeah, it's going to be painful, it's going to be a little weird, and getting your body ready for that and your mind ready for it too. Really important.
Yeah. Oh, I love like what you're saying about like, there's a huge aspect here of just kind of recognizing that it's going to be difficult and it's going to be uncomfortable. But then also there's like logistical prep to optimize your sessions and making it more comfortable for yourself. One note that just to kind of add on to that, where I felt a lot of struggle going outdoors a lot, because I didn't go outdoors often, but I would go for longer trips. It's just like how when I was in high school or like for competitions and whatnot, I would go for like 2-week trips or whatever, but I would only do that like once or twice or maybe 3 times a year. And I would very rarely have short trips. And what that meant was my diet would change. My water drinking habits would change. And that stuff led to my fatigue a lot more than I thought. And lately, Michaela, my girlfriend's been researching a lot about that type of diet and like, you know, having a more sustainable type of diet and what kind of foods you need. And I'm not going to quote those things because I'm not very well versed in that stuff. But that's the point there, is maybe you guys should research for yourselves, or like look into for yourself, and everybody's a little bit different here, and research for yourselves what makes you feel like you have the best energy. And the reason why I say that is because it's fairly obvious, but I know for me, I Red Bull. And there you go. That was just me being kind of dumb and relying on one aspect, which is a quick answer, versus fixing like a root cause of like where I was feeling maybe more tired from. But to be fair, the Red Bull did come already after like 4-hour sessions at the night, when I would go in night session. Usually I would go in night session after long sessions. So that was a little bit specific, came later. But man, I didn't eat so good. I didn't drink so much water. And apparently that stuff has a huge impact on your levels of energy in the daytime, especially when you're doing athletic endeavors. And so outside, especially when in drier environments, you're going to be more dehydrated and whatnot. Let's just face it, we don't drink enough water outdoors, or I don't for sure. And I don't see people drinking as much water outdoors. I don't see people eating as much outdoors, and you're out there for a lot longer than you think. And so sometimes it's as easy as getting a bar, but sometimes you might need a little bit more substantial of a thing. Like I said, do your research. I'm definitely going to be preparing more nutrition type things for my logistics outdoors, because I want energy outside, man. Like I want to go outside and feel good and like not feel fatigued just because I'm not eating or drinking enough. That was one big kind of logistical answer I had there. And I had another one.
Sound old, man. That's old man talk. I used to not care. Just give me Red Bull and whiskey and I'm just good to go running around.
Yeah, I literally also would have like whiskey and Red Bull outside, just because like it would either warm me up or like, but yeah, there's definitely some more logistical approaches. Okay, I have one. I just lost a train of thought, but I have it. And this kind of changes gears a bit. But another logistical approach that can make a lot of things easier outside, which is something that I have been explaining to kids that I coach as to reasons why maybe they're not so good at sequencing. But take this with a grain of salt. There's both a good and a bad about this. There's a lot of beta available for you guys out there nowadays. Kaya is a really, really easy thing to go on and be like, dude, if you want to look up any, and I'm sure a lot of you guys use this already because it's a pretty obvious feature, but if you look up any climb, you can find like 10 at least beta videos of this climb. And the point there isn't to watch people do this climb and maybe pay attention to a lot more than what you're usually paying attention to. look at the foot choices. Look at all the relative foot choices. Sometimes what I do is I watch videos of people. I go to the boulder and then I watch more videos of the people, because then I've found the information that I feel and, you know, have my own opinions, and then I check what people are doing. And the point there is, again, not to just use the video and, you know, follow what they do, but pay attention to why people are using the beta that they are using. It's a very significant point there, because climbing really is about opinions and your confidence, and your opinions and your confidence and your biases will change according to everybody else's, and everybody else is going to have their own. And so when you watch beta be, this is a double-sided thing, is in use beta, but then be careful when you're using beta videos and whatnot, right? It's like you can use beta videos in a good and a bad way, is kind of what I'm saying. And so what's a bad way to use it? A bad way to use it is to copy somebody else, okay, without actually questioning what somebody else is doing. It's not to say that you're going to not do exactly what you're watching. You might, you know, and you, actually a lot of the time you might, right? But because outdoors has so many options, there's so many different, you know, changing factors. You've heard the podcast, guys. You've listened to the podcast. There's so many ways to climb. There's so many ways to use a handhold, to use a foothold, and there's different levels of operation to that, and there's different levels of, you know, relationships between the footholds that you're using, the handholds that you're using. But let's just face it, those things have to be dependent on you. And then, you know, that would be the good way to use it is, interesting. So they're using that in this. Yeah, Josh wants to go in. Go in.
The reason I'm just laughing, because my advice just does not make sense at all, where I watch a lot of beta videos. Of course you watch, you know, just YouTube and Kaya. Like before you go out and see a boulder, it's just, you can't help it. And my advice would be that way more often than you think, you're going to do different beta. And then in the next breath, I would say, and way more often than you think, you're going to use the exact same beta. And it's really hard to know what to do, because there's so many times that I've tried to get clever and I'm like, no, that's the foot. It just is. Like you're not using it right. You think like it feels awkward, but that's the foot, and you need to just adapt to that really jug foot. And then there's so many times where people are doing beta and I'm just like, why would anyone do it like that? You could just put your foot over here. And it's just funny, because in both instances, I feel like it happens more often than I realize, both doing it exactly like everyone does it and just acknowledging that, and then doing it completely different. And you have to be open to both of that. And I don't really have a good way to sort that exactly, other than, you know, that's what we try to talk about over and over again, because there is no way for us to puppet you from afar when you go in and try to solve it. And just like, you know, and the struggle is always there for us as well. And hopefully the more you do it, the more you build that intuition when to do the thing that works for you in the long run.
Yeah. But I honestly, that's the difference between good and great in outdoor climbers, is the people who can, you know, find the beta and believe in the beta. You know, I mean, everyone can find the beta nowadays. It's just, that's the point, right? Like everybody can get told how to do something, and everybody can go look at a video on how to do something. And because someone's doing it, it's probably successful. But, you know, there's always that interesting climber you're going to climb with outside who's like, nah, like I'm going to do this way. And it's like, really? Like, really, dude? Like, that's pretty crazy, you know? And then lo and behold, they pull on, it looks pretty easy and it looks pretty comfortable for them and whatnot. And they just know, dude, that. And
I don't know if this is me, but I find that a lot of the boulders I get on don't have much video. And I guess it's because I'm not going to these places that are, you know, it's like, oh, like you're going to go do Loaded Direct in Waco that has been done hundreds of times or something. And there's a pluses and minuses to that. It's frustrating for flashing, but I got to tell you, some of my best memories in climbing, whether it was, I think the two that really stick out in my head are Luminance and Crown Jewel, where I think me and my crew got, you know, like the third and fourth and fifth ascent or something. Like we heard about it. Maybe we saw one video, like a crappy video, and then you go and you do it. And it's fun to look at, especially like look at some tall piece of rock, and that's relatively hard. I mean, these weren't V15, but they're in the like V10 range. And you go like, okay, I don't really know what to do. Like I don't really know. And I'm not saying that's like a lost art or something. And if you send me out to do some Joe's Valley V10 classic, I'm going to look at beta videos. Like I'm just going to, I don't know, I can't help it. But it's funny how often I find myself not knowing good beta. And that's fun also. So I don't know what the lesson is there. Maybe you do learn more by being forced into finding your own way. And hey, I'm not saying like you should artificially restrict yourself and not watch beta videos, but just kind of making me reflect on my career where I had less videos when I was younger.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was, I'm glad you kind of revisited the point that I was making when I started saying that, which was the kids. When I coach kids, I always tell them, I'm like, it's because you have access to a lot of information that it becomes pretty difficult. And like, I know I'm younger than you, but I had also a similar approach in a lot of aspects where I couldn't really find information on things that I was trying, especially on like the harder grades. Anything above V10 was like hard to find more than one video on. But nowadays, like that's not necessarily the case for, and maybe kids are going towards more things that are mainstream because there is more information out there. And maybe they're not trying things that are like, well, I can't find beta on that one, so I'm not going to try that. I'm like, well, somebody told me it was really hard and that's why I tried those climbs. That's pretty much what I was trying back in the day. Or somebody told me it was really cool and then I found, and I was like, huh. And so I think the lesson there is, what did you ask yourself on when you came to a crux, when you came to a place you didn't know, when you came to, but the goals are the same. The goals are, you know, you and I and all the kids and everybody else and every other climber out there wants to get from the start to the top, right? That's the goals are the same, but how you get the goals done were a little bit different, right? For you, you know, what you always did was you asked your body, what should I do to stick this move? You asked your body, where can I use this foot? What foot can I use? You know, what can I do that? And then through doing that over and over again, you got better at it, right? Because it's really difficult to do that because right away your body's going to be like, nope, can't do that. Nope, can't use that. Nope, you're too weak. Nope, you're too, whatever, right? And then you start to know the difference between your emotional feelings and then the realistic feelings where you're like, no, even though it feels horrible, I can do that and I'm going to do that, right? And you got really, really good at that. And I guess that's the big point there is that if climbers don't ask themselves what they're supposed to do and they ask the beta videos, they ask their friends, if they ask everybody else, then maybe they're not learning as good, right? And so that's one really important aspect of climbing as a whole, but specifically outdoor climbing is if you're going to go outside and you're going to try some things, get good at learning, get better at learning. And the way you can get better at learning is to ask yourself and not somebody else. And just because you are struggling with finding those answers, it doesn't mean that you're bad at learning or like bad at anything. It means you're struggling. And everybody has struggled. Everybody who's good at learning has struggled. Everybody had that frustration in the beginning where like, God damn, I was like, I just can't trust, but I don't know, dude, like I can't get that height. Like I just can't trust that. Like I just can't pull here, you know? And it's like, well, figure it out, dude. Like figure it out because you're going to figure it out.
Still happens where you get all set on some beta and then your buddy's like, did you ever try just standing up on this jib and stare at this foot chip? You go, oh, you jerk. Yeah. Like, it's so easy now. What was I doing? I'm glad that you brought up some of this reading stuff, sequencing and reading outdoors versus indoors, because I just totally didn't even think of that at all when I was doing my prep, where it was just, well, you're going to go from indoors to outdoors. And that is such a huge component. It's something I really noticed with my wife previously, my girlfriend, when I took her climbing and she was so strong in the gym and just completely struggled outdoors. And we would then kind of marionette her up it, which is exactly what we're saying not to do, where we would just say, okay, Jess, put your foot here. Just put your foot here. Because like, she goes, why? It's like, that's the foot that's going to work for you because it's high up and you're going to need that. And she didn't really understand. Like we tried to explain it to her, but she kind of needed to figure it out on her own. And so I'm just glad you brought that up. And one thing that we've talked about this with, I don't know, I think we talked about this with Eric Jerome. This is kind of off topic, but it's one of the things I love about outdoor climbing, and indoor climbing has this to some extent when we see it on the moon board, but I just described some of those climbs that I had done where there wasn't a lot of beta videos. And I just encourage everyone to lean into those moments where something just captures your imagination, whether you saw media around it, or you heard about it on a podcast, or you walked by a boulder and just wondered, what the hell is that? And it actually goes into, I think that was Roman Yalowitz's pro tip was, find out what you're psyched on. And when I think about Luminance or Crown Jewel, and the reason why they stuck out in my head is that it wasn't so much like everyone's, oh, you know, like I mentioned Loaded Direct. So Loaded Direct is like a V11 or something in Waco that everyone walks by. Great climb. Really cool. And you can just watch video after video after video. Really popular. but it is so fun and satisfying to just catch a glimpse of something, some video you're just on YouTube, you hear about, you know, someone listening is going to say like, what's luminance, you know, and then they'll go dig that up. And, you know, for me, I saw a climbing article drop on it when Sean Diamond did it. And it was just like, you know, it sounded death defying and crazy and hard and wild. And you rally this crew and you just get inspired. You're like, okay, guys, like, let's go find, like, what the hell is this? Let's go find out. Let's go find out about it and do it. And you get some like murmurs from people like, oh, that hole's not as big of a jug as it looks like from down there. Or you inspect it yourself. And just, I encourage people to lean into that adventure where you get a glimpse, you get inspired, you get, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's what a real adventure is. And that has nothing to do with what we're talking about other than that's my advice. Have an adventure.
Oh, but it's a lost art in climbing outdoors that is being replaced by testing yourself outdoors. And, you know, people are realizing in this day and age, in this generation, that, you know, well, the outdoor grades are more legit because they stay there and the indoor grades maybe don't matter as much. Honestly, that's the thing that I feel is happening in the generation nowadays. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's awesome. You know, and that's a really cool opportunity that maybe Josh didn't have growing up. And I have a little bit of both. And I definitely think the lost art is, it's fun in its own ways. And I think the key there that we were kind of just talking about was that it teaches you more, like it teaches you a lot more. And so if you're interested in getting better, maybe invite that old lost art of adventure into your bouldering, because right now it's not so common. And Jimmy Webb is still doing it all the time, I think. Like Jimmy seems like somebody who's finding those things and then creating those challenges and being like, all right, guys, like, you know, I said it was pretty hard. Somebody go out and find it. And there's a couple of people going out there and trying to repeat those things. And I, for one, definitely want to go and do that, but it's definitely lost. And, you know, people aren't as inspired to do that, or it's a very select few, but there's a reason why it's significant. There's a reason why it's fun, but also there's a reason why it's good for you. And so as a kind of the, hopefully some insights into Josh living as an adventurous boulderer and seeing the things that he's learned are very natural to him about the sequencing and stuff outside that, you know, maybe explaining to your wife was really difficult, your girlfriend at the time, and definitely obvious why, because she wasn't looking for that adventure as much. She was looking for maybe testing yourself or having fun. And so again, nothing wrong with whatever you guys want to do outdoors, but if you want to get better, if you want to get better, you got to introduce a new mindset into your climbing and your adventures. And so don't ask about getting better if you're not willing to do that. But
well, that's a tough. And this doesn't have to be in this the super hard grades. You know, go do, when I did Sheep Herder and the Hunk, Tim, you know, I didn't watch a video and I didn't know anything about them, and they're tall and scary and you don't really know what's going to, oh, dude, one time I found a guy at the bottom of Sheep Herder with a extremely broken ankle.
It was really
gnarly. So, you know, it's it was so bad. He was like, hey dude, and he was pretty calm. He was like, hey, could you take my shoe off? Like, these are new. I, you know, like, I don't want them to cut it off. I want to save my shoe. And I was just like, no, dude, I'm not touching your ankle. That's facing the wrong way. Like, no, be careful out there, guys.
Dude.
Tangent. But I guess my point is I'm always stunned by, you get onto some really good moderate, or, you know, moderate for you that maybe you don't have any beta on, and just how difficult it can be. I remember getting on some V7 last year up in Boreal, up here in Tahoe. That was like a classic and was great, but it was so difficult and so cryptic. And it took me many tries to do it. And it was just a blast and fun. And, you know, just throw the grade out the window. Just go have that learning experience. And this is where it's so important to be open-minded. Actually, not even just open-minded. I always say this, it's more about having respect for every climb, because you have no idea what it's going to be like. And grades are historically actually used to let you know what you're getting yourself into, right? It's like, hey, just a heads up, this is hard. And not so much like, this is hard and thus you're great. It's more like a warning, like, if you're going to tie in and go up this, like, you know, just a heads up, this is hard. And the side note to that is that this is where you need to respect each climb, and you can get your ass kicked on any grade, you can fall off. I mean, clearly you can fall off a V0. Of course you can fall off anything, but you know, if you come at it with the wrong mentality, not only will you get shut down sometimes and then your ego hurts, you also might be prone to climb it in a suboptimal way, like forcing it, making a V6 into a V10 just because you get angry at it. But then without that respect, you also reduce your chances of learning, where if you just start opening yourself up to this experience, and I'll say this again, funky tut, V3, you got to stand on this foot. And I encourage anyone of any grade who has not done it, who's going to go to Bishop this year, to just go do it. And it's a V3. And a lot of you will just do it. Like, I'm not saying you won't do it. It still is just a V3, but enjoying that process of putting your foot on that dime. And I don't care. Well, I'm not going to say I don't care how strong of a climber you are. There are going to be people who are extremely experienced outdoors, extremely good at climbing, you know, V13 strong, and they're just going to put their foot on, rock over and do it. But my hunch is most of you, whether you climb V13 or below, will have a moment where you put your foot on and you go like, oh, Jesus, like, what the fuck? Like, really? Really, Tim? Really, Josh? Like, V3, huh? Okay, I'm going for it. And you'll do it, or it may take you a few tries, but being open to that experience is, and respecting it for what it is, will lead to a lot of learning and a lot of enjoyment, I would argue.
Dude, that is such a cool point. It's cool that you're taking it back to like what grades are supposed to be for, and like, you know, the skull symbols or hospital symbols, R's, X's, you know, like those are more obvious ways to kind of talk about why you should respect the climb. But honestly, the grades themselves are a way that you should respect the climbs too. And then understanding the grades for the area is also a very important aspect of that. Not taking your, well, I've been sending this grade on the moon board, so if I go outside, for sure, these are going to feel easy for me, right? It's like, well, you don't know anything about climbing then. Climbing is a different system. You know, your level as a climber is not given to you because you have a resume of sending climbs, right? And so when you go outside, check yourself and check your level, and you check your level by sending or falling, honestly, but you should check your level and just have respect and be open-minded and not tell the climb what level you are. Don't tell the climb what level you are. The climb doesn't give a shit. You just try. And if the climb will tell you what level the climb is, too. And then it'll kick your ass.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, this is the thing is I took the other side of it. I was cocky, and then you just get your ass kicked. And that's just how, especially in places like Yosemite or Bishop or Squamish, often these cryptic granite places where I will have some great season in Waco and I'll be strong on the board, know what I'm doing. And then you toss me on something thin and cryptic in granite and you just go, oh, I don't know what I'm talking about. I am an idiot. And, I guess I'm trying to save you all the pain of being cocky and having an ego and then being like, why do I suck then? Like, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? Is it temps? Do I eat the wrong thing? And it's like, no, each climb is just a climb. And we've talked about this a bunch of times, is be careful being closed-minded, thinking you're an expert, because as soon as you think you have it figured out, then you're not learning anymore. And I think you made this point that I really liked, is that everyone is still learning, whether you climb V17 or not. It's not like, you know, Sean Rabatou and Aiden Roberts did V17. They're like, okay, I'm done with climbing. I have figured it out. You know, I did it. Check. You know, it's a continual process. And as soon as you think you figured it out, you're in trouble, because that's the number one sign that you haven't figured it out.
Yeah. It's good. I like that. I have one more, this type of, you know, talking kind of got me to my last point. This is the last point I'll make for transitioning into the outdoors. And this point is on commitment. Commitment is not a contingency to climb well indoors. It's not necessarily a contingency to climb well outdoors, but it'll help. And commitment is basically making an agreement and a decision with yourself to follow through with mechanical decisions that you're going to have, or a battle that you're about to have, right? It's just an acknowledgement. It's this recognition that Josh is talking about. It's a commitment. It's an agreement to yourself. And that stuff is practicable indoors, and that's pretty much all it is. If you just do it indoors, it's not very rewarding, honestly. It's not that special or whatever. It's just like, oh, well, that happened. The consequences are pretty low indoors, but outdoors, the consequences are high. The feeling is elevated. It's intense. It's a very different type of stimulation, and it's horrible. It's a horrible feeling. And I can tell you from highballing, it's wonderfully horrible, right? And it's that type of, it's that type of type two, intense stimulation. But honestly, if you are not ready for it, it can be even more horrible. If you're not practiced in it and you try to do it, it can be even more horrible and can be extremely dangerous, right? Outdoor climbing is no joke. It's very dangerous outside if you aren't prepped for it, right? And there's physical prep. Yes, there's logistical prep. Yes, there's mental prep. And this is that side of mental prep, which I think matters a lot. And again, it's not just say go outside and just start committing to things. It's not to say that. It's, get comfortable and get intimate with when you are in a committed headspace, your mind starts to make decisions a little bit differently. It starts to have a different timeline for how to make decisions. There's time bombs and time tickers for how to make decisions and whatnot. And you need to get intimate with that. And really experienced climbers and really strong climbers who can commit are really intimate with this type of stuff. And I for sure as hell am. And sometimes it's done by, I'll go into the pragmatic approach after Josh kind of goes on in that.
I know. I'm sorry. I just started laughing because you're like committed, intimate. I'm like, are you talking about your girlfriend or climbing outdoors? Like, who do you love more, dog? Well, actually, I'll let you get practical and then we can wrap things up.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in the gym that are pretty simple, practical things. For example, the moonboard for me is like, will not go well if I'm not committed. I'll just say that. Sometimes it's a, accepting of pain. It's an accepting of, hey, this move is going to be pretty thrutchy. Even if I cut feet or don't cut feet, it's going to be thrutchy and I just have to go and grab that hold by any means necessary, which is a conversation I was having with Nate yesterday about, how I want him to go and try return of the sleepwalker, because it's like maybe he's committed to making the climb feel perfect, but maybe he's not committed to making the climb send. Right. And he was like, and I actually agree with that. And hopefully he sends it today, man. Who knows what's going to happen? But by any means necessary is something that Justin Shong, who was the kind of original climbing sensei, taught me when I was younger, when it was 5 or 6 years ago.
And
that's something that is a part of commitment. And I taught myself that, over the next 5 years. Obviously, it's getting to me to a place where I am now. And that's been a pretty significant thing in indoor and outdoor climbing. But like I said, the indoors is where we practice it. And outdoors is where we hopefully it shows up and when we want it to. And it's not always fun to climb like that, in my opinion. It's not always a thing that literally always shows up from attempt to attempt. Sometimes there are attempts where I want to recon a little bit and just find things. And Josh made a point earlier about skin management. And you don't always want to have the go. You got to pick and choose your battles, of course. But when you choose your battles and you know when the battle is the battle, commit and learn how to commit. Learn what commitment is, go in the gym and see the little battles you can have in the gym. Like, oh, there's this dynamic move at the top of the wall. Well, okay, let me size up this fall and go for it. And then I will commit for it and know the difference between when you're committed and when you're not committing for it. Do a simpler move, even lower. Go find a horrible foothold that you probably will slip on and do the move until it doesn't slip. And even though you know the volatility of that move is high, you'll be proud of yourself for committing on that movement, right? And it's not so much about sticking the move or, just getting climbs done necessarily, but it's about teaching yourself that level of commitment and getting intimate with that level of commitment. Yes, Josh, I'm talking about rock climbing and not relationships.
Get intimate with it. Get intimate. Tim, it just made me think of your quote that you say a lot, and that's prove it. And I use this a lot when I ask myself, what would Tim do or what would Tim tell me to do? It's this thing about, well, it ties in with commitment. It's like, oh, your foot's going to pop on funky tut when you put all that weight on and go for that move. Really? Prove it. Like, you really think it's going to? Like, okay, maybe you're right. Commit and prove me that your foot's going to pop. And it's so fascinating when that feeling, when you commit and you're like, my foot's going to pop, but I'm going to put all my weight on it anyways. And that stays. And you're like, whoa, I just learned something. Tim, I'm going to wrap it there. This was an interesting one. We didn't have quite our lighthearted banter at the beginning because we have been in like heated talks and texts and conversations about all that stuff with Sean before. And hopefully that, brings some value to you guys. It's a hot topic behind the scenes. And I'll say it again, to Sean or anyone out there, I am here to brainstorm. I'm not charging money. I want to help pro climbers make a living for themselves and offer up that value that they have earned throughout their career to the rest of the world. The rest of the world does value it. Let's figure out how to put it out there so that you can earn a living and keep on doing what you're doing because I love what you're doing. I know I contribute money to the climbing community And I think there's other people who want to do it, but you have to figure out how to package that to be successful. And then we transition to smoking joints with Sharma. And then we're going outdoors and getting intimate with The Rock and having adventures. I'm glad we went through the full arc, because it was intense in the beginning, and now you're laughing and I'm laughing too. And that was fun, man. So, let's get out there. Good luck on Sleepwalker to you, and Return of the Sleepwalker to Nate. Please, I will grill you next time about if it went or not, because, the world wants to know. I want to know. I want to see it happen. I want that send video, dude.
Sounds good. We have not received Vegas temps yet. We did for one day, and hopefully they'll come soon. But we're not there yet. It's still in the 70s as the highs. Okay. So it's not perfect for sending, but we'll get there soon.
Well, get out at night, bring some Red Bull, and get that psycho and listen to that Slipknot.
Sounds good.
All right, guys. Take care. See you next time.
See you guys.
Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.